Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's part two of our discussion of a movie, Surviving Prostate Cancer Without Surgery, Drugs, or Radiation. We have with us Peter Starr. Peter Starr is someone who has a lot of production credits, including TV specials, recording, national radio programs. He also has a career doing motorcycle stunt work in major Hollywood films, including Batman and Robin, Apollo 13, Lethal Weapons 3. That's pretty cool. I may have seen you in some of those movies. And he is also a courageous advocate for taking a different approach to prostate cancer, having been diagnosed himself with prostate cancer in June of 2004. That makes, roughly 16 years. Sorry?
12 years.
12 years of, right, 12 years of survival with prostate cancer without conventional treatment. Am I correct?
That's correct, yes.
So what have you done? What type of lifestyle changes, diet changes have you explored in heading off a recurrence of prostate cancer?
Well, what I learned, and I didn't learn all of this immediately. It took a while. I read lots. In fact, I probably read every book about prostate cancer that's ever been printed at some point, including the original book I was told to read by Patrick Walsh, who looks at surgery as being, quote, the gold standard. But what I found was that there's a couple of people on the outside of medicine that was talking about what we eat, the way we think, and I started to study those things. And the first thing I changed was my diet. I absolutely cut out red meat. I continued to eat fish, and I would eat chicken if it was definitely free-range, grass-fed, no antibiotics, no hormones, but not a lot of it. I ate a lot of vegetables, cut down on things that would create sugar in the body. I cut down on the carbohydrates that turn into sugar really quickly. Mm-hmm. And that was my first real change. The second change was dealing with toxins that I would have in my body that I thought. And the first one was the amalgam fillings in my mouth. I read a lot about mercury poisoning and mercury in the prostate. And, you know, the four heavy metals that we find in prostate cancer are mercury, nickel, lead, and cadmium. And I had something like 14 amalgam fillings in my mouth, and I had one root canal that was bad. Mm. And that was bad enough that the tooth had broke, and the gum had receded, and so I spent a lot of time and a lot of money on my mouth, took all the amalgams out, had the root canal fixed, and the root canal was on the number one tooth at the front. You know, the two, I was just as television, I'm pointing to them, but the two top teeth and the two bottom teeth at the front of the mouth, that sits on the prime meridian that goes through the reproductive system. Hmm. And the root canal that I had that had gone bad was in the upper right front of those four teeth that I'm talking about. Hmm. And I just sort of, anything that I thought would have a change on the toxicity in my body, I would do. I did a number of fasts, for detox fasts, one of which you might know as a lemonade fast, which mm-hmm. is basically, it is a cleansing fast, and you can live on it for quite a while. Some people have gone over 30 days without anything. I do it. I used to do it for 8 days. I haven't done it in the last 4 or 5 years, but I do try to monitor whatever toxins I'm picking up. The third thing that I looked at when I learned about it was the hormonal balance, and I learned most of that by interviewing two doctors, Dr. Jay Mead, who runs a laboratory in Portland called Labrix, and he's an endocrinologist and a pathologist, and he's also medical director of that lab, and the other was Dr. Abraham Morgenthaler, and from those two gentlemen alone, those two doctors alone, I learned so much about the importance of hormonal balance that I started to do that and have watched it ever since. And in fact, we talked about testosterone. I'm actually on subcutaneous testosterone at the moment.
Well, that's a controversial choice because many conventional urologists would be aghast at the notion that you're taking testosterone, which could stimulate growth of the cancer, and yet that's something that works for you.
Well, I try to turn them on to what Dr. Morgenthaler has found and say, please read this. And there's not only the book, but there's other papers that he's written as well. And I just feel so much better. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty interesting thing. And I'm not saying I'm going to stay on it forever. I'm on it right now, and it seems to be working for me right now. But I, as I said, I monitor myself frequently, and not only for the cancer, but I monitor everything. I mean, there is no cancer at the moment. It hasn't been for about the past 6 years. But in fact, I'm going to have a 3D color Doppler on the 7th of March, which is the way that I choose to monitor it. And we always monitor the PSA. And there's another test which I may do this year called Oncoblot. I don't know whether you're familiar with
yes.
the Oncoblot test. I've been talking to the people that started that, and I may become a guinea pig for them. And because it's a way to monitor very, very small amounts of prostate cancer, and they can measure the fact that it's from the prostate and not from some other part of the body. And I'm quite excited by that particular thing, because that alone might save a lot of people having biopsies.
Mm-hmm. However, because of the sensitivity of the test, it might suggest the presence of small amounts of cancer, which then could propel people to unnecessarily to aggressive conventional therapy. But for your purposes, it's to sort of give you a report card. How am I doing? Because you already know the cat's out of the bag. You already have a diagnosis.
Yeah. And the other thing which I've learned is, just because you've got a diagnosis isn't a death sentence. It's just not. I mean, when you look at the statistics even, I look at the statistics of prostate cancer patients from other parts of the world, which are low, as opposed to here, which are high, and say, what are those guys doing there that we're not doing? Or, you know, what stress levels do they live under? You know, where does their food come from? How much of the prepackaged, fabricated food do they eat as opposed to what we eat? Things like that is part of the study that I do to tell people, look, you're not going to die tomorrow. This is not pancreatic cancer. And you have a little time to play with changing your diet and lifestyle and look at the way other people do it. I mean, it's very, very obvious to me when black men in Africa get very, very low rates of prostate cancer, but black men here have a 30% higher rate than white people do and a 50% higher death rate. Japanese men in Japan have, up until the introduction of the Western diet and lifestyle, had an incredibly low rate of prostate cancer. But Japanese men that came to live in America and adopted the American diet and lifestyle adopted also the same rate of prostate cancer diagnosis as a regular American does. So those things have to be communicated to men to say, look, think about this for a little while before you jump into the deep dip of conventional treatment. Now, I'm not saying, believe me, there's no judgment in this at all. If somebody says, you know, I feel better doing robotic surgery because, God bless you, you know, please come back and see me afterwards. Let's see how you're doing.
Sort of the Angelina Jolie school of thought. If you have a high risk for cancer, you know, better remove the offending organs. That is one choice if it gives you peace of mind, but it isn't the right choice for everyone.
Well, I didn't even think it was a very good choice, period, because rather than study the subject, she should have cut off. I think it's important to say that the condition that allows the cancer to take hold doesn't start in the organ where the cancer actually takes hold, particularly the prostate or the breast.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's a systemic problem that
right.
you really should address first. And if you address the systemic problem, the chances are that you will never get the cancer in those organs. And let's face it, prostate cancer and breast cancer have a lot of parallels.
Are there any key supplements that you have embraced? Did your research reveal that taking certain supplements might be a good idea?
Yes. In fact, my foundation has a booklet called Supplements for a Healthy Prostate, which we give away to people when I give a talk. People come up and ask questions afterwards. I usually give them a copy of this booklet, and it lists all of the supplements that we believe has a positive effect in the right quantities on the health of the prostate.
Is that available to listeners? Is that something our listeners can obtain?
Yes, if you go to it's not on the website yet. We're going to make it available as a download, but it's not there yet. I'll be quite honest, I'm not very computer. I'm computer challenged,
to put
it that way. But we will have it as a download shortly, and people can just get on and download it.
But offhand, what are some of those?
Zinc, for sure. And one of the things you'll notice from all of the prostate supplements that you can see in the local stores is most of them have zinc, but they have it in such small doses. They are 5 to 15 milligrams. And if you think you've got a problem, you should be up to the 50 milligram level mm-hmm. for zinc. Selenium. I see selenium in such low quantities in supplements. And, you know, basically, we think if you're eligible for prostate cancer, you should be at the 200 microgram level. Mm-hmm. D3, obviously, has become like the golden child of everything these days. Mm-hmm. And certainly, we look at the D3 being from 50 to 70 at the minimum, if you think you're going to be eligible for prostate cancer. And I see frequently blood tests come across my desk where the D3 is down in the 20s and 30s, mm-hmm. and yet that conventional general practitioner has said, oh, you're within the scale. Mm-hmm. Well, you're within the medical scale, but you're not within the functional scale. Mm-hmm. And what we try to do is get people into the functional scale. And by the way, before you think, in case you think I'm practicing medicine, I work with two MDs, by the way, on everything we do. I'm merely the coach. Mm-hmm. I learn a lot of this stuff because I absorb it like a sponge, but I don't want you to think that I'm practicing medicine by telling people what to do. I work with two MDs, and they're the people that do the recommendations. I'm merely the coach. Good. And I'm there sort of the front line.
But any other for your favorite supplements?
Well, of course, I prefer flax to fish oil. And there's a fair amount of data out of Canada that would suggest that flax oil is better for you than fish oil for EPA and DHA. Though the general supplements are important. I don't take excessive vitamin C. I do like to keep my D3's levels up. Mm-hmm. And I like to do it in the sunshine rather than getting it out of a bottle. So I try to get out into the sun as much as I can. And living in California, that's a lot easier than you living in New York.
Indeed.
In fact, there is good statistics to show that people in Hawaii, as an example, have a lower rate of prostate cancer than people that live in Boston. And likewise, people that are in Florida that get a lot of sunshine have a lower rate of prostate cancer than people that live in Wisconsin. There's some things that I don't do. I don't eat dairy food at all.
Right. What's your theory on dairy? Why is dairy considered potentially harmful?
Well, basically, your conventional milk has so many chemicals in it. It's barely better than water with chemicals. I'm not saying that raw milk from the cow that's on, you know, grass-fed, free-range, doesn't have benefits. I mean, I've studied that side of it, too. I choose not to drink it because of the protein casein. Mm-hmm. Which and there's some controversy over that, but I tend to believe what I read in the China study about the fact that casein has been directly related to breast and prostate cancers.
There's also some concern about galactose, which is one of the sugars in dairy, that may yes. promote ovarian cancer in women and possibly prostate cancer in men.
Yeah, I just choose to stay away from it, and even though I may not know all of the reasons why. It just doesn't make sense to me to be. The other part of it is, let's face it, we are the only mammal that I know of that continues to drink the milk of another species at all into adulthood. You know, and it's full of bovine growth factors and mm-hmm. things like that designed to grow a calf up into a 3,000-pound cow. I just don't think that can be good for you.
Right. Good point. What about the role of exercise in your regimen?
I ride a bicycle regularly. I should lift weights more than I do. I don't. I just don't like going to the gym, I must admit. But I do enjoy riding my bicycle, and I ride a fair amount. But on my bicycle seat, you'd like this. In fact, I should send you a copy of this. I've had a bicycle seat made that's just two pieces of rubber, of sponge covered with leather. Instead of having a seat where it puts pressure on the perineum,
right.
I've got these two pads. So with the bicycle I ride, I've just got these two pads that my butt sits on, mm-hmm. but no pressure mm-hmm. on the perineum. And I've done the same on my motorcycle. I do a fair amount of motorcycle riding, and I had a seat made with a divot down the middle.
Right.
So when I ride, I'm supported only by the two outside bits and no pressure in the middle.
Indeed.
Little things like that I've found, and I'm thinking of trying to think of a way to actually sell that technology to the motorcycle community. And
it's actually something that some bicyclists prefer because some men, forget prostate cancer, they experience something called pudendal neuralgia, which is no picnic when it comes to having an active sex life. You actually deaden the nerve that leads down to the penis from pressure on the perineum. Fortunately, that's not something I've experienced with long hours of bicycling because I guess I have the right shape butt to sit on those hard seats.
My idea about exercise is you don't need to be over-exercise, but you do need to exercise. And if I can't ride my bicycle for any reason, I'll go out and go for a walk. And, a brisk walk, just to do something. Because, a lot of the times we sit in front of a computer like we are right now. And I try not to sit in front of my computer for more than 15 minutes at one sitting before getting up and running up and down the stairs up to my office,
Right, which may promote lymphatic circulation and help to thereby detoxify the body. What about the role of soy? Soy, controversial for some people. Soy is a plus, do you think, in this kind of setting?
No, I don't think it is. And the reason is that we used to think that the Japanese and Chinese ate a lot of soy. And what we found out is that it isn't as much as we originally thought. We thought originally that soy was a contributing factor to the lack of prostate cancer over there. And the general opinion that I'm reading today is that that is not necessarily so. And there's the added controversy about the fact that soy will stimulate estrogen. And we're all concerned with the estradiol factor in the male. And if I want a part of what we try to do with measuring the hormones is to measure the estradiol versus free testosterone.
So-called aromatization of testosterone is problematic, you think?
Right, yes. Absolutely. And then, adding, if you're taking supplements for hormones, the importance of putting in progesterone to help deal with that, help deal with the estrogen.
To balance it out, even for men.
Right.
So what can our listeners expect if they go to survivingprostatecancer.org and buy the DVD? There are 56 doctors who share the truth about natural healing and prostate cancer to help you avoid impotence, incontinence, and most importantly, the return of the cancer. Really, 56 doctors you interviewed for this? Who are some of those?
I did, and you would probably know most of them, actually.
Yes.
Although my memory is such that I can never always remember them off the top of my head. But,
Julian Whittaker is among them, I saw, yeah.
Morgenthaler, Howard Robbins from New York, who's an ozone therapist there, Julian Kenyon in the UK, Mark Emberton in the UK, Doug Mitchell in Australia, Thomas Rau in Switzerland, who I think is one of the most enlightened persons I've ever spoken to with regards to prostate cancer. In Switzerland, they actually have an area, a canton, as they call it, called Lustmuller, where all of the doctors there, they may be MD qualified, and they may have MD after the name, but they all practice naturopathically. And he has a naturopathic clinic there, and it's accepted and supported in terms of insurance by the Swiss government. It's accepted as being a working way to go.
Excellent.
Big difference to the way that we deal with it here or in the UK, unfortunately. But I went to Germany and interviewed Dr. Friedrich Dauers, who practices hypothermia for prostate cancer.
Right.
Oh, goodness, there's so many of them when I come to think of it. Dr. Mead, of course, who I mentioned early on. And I wish I had the list in front of me, unfortunately. Nope. But there's 42 MDs, 12 NDs, and the rest were PhDs. Because a lot of the stuff is pure research, and I got a lot of that information from PSA researchers, PhD researchers.
So in sum, what's today's intelligent medicine call to action? First of all, people should go to the website, inform themselves, survivingprostatecancer.org. Lots of information there, but you can also buy the DVD. And you can also work in conjunction with physicians, but I think you're based on the West Coast, correct?
That's correct. But what my foundation is doing, we're actually trying to get the funding to do this. Nothing exists to my knowledge there where I can refer a patient that calls in to our foundation locally. In other words, just yesterday, for instance, I had a call from someone in the northern end of Connecticut who's got a diagnosis, had bought the documentary, looked at it, and said, I want to try this. I want to go this route. Do you know a doctor that will work with me? Mm-hmm. And the answer is I didn't. So I had to do some research. So what we're trying to do around the country is put a list together of doctors that are prepared to treat prostate cancer patients from a holistic, natural point of view initially, and measuring it. Mm-hmm. And then if it works, terrific. If it doesn't work,
monitoring them responsibly.
Exactly. And also watching what they do and how they do it and advising them. The last thing that I do is try to tell people what to do. I'm trying to be an educator. And the two doctors that I work with here mainly handle local clients, people that call me up and said, I want to try this. And I say, okay, go to you're this end of town, go to this doctor. You're at that end of town, the other one. Or I've got a doctor in Phoenix, for instance. You and I should talk perhaps privately about this after this interview. Because I'm liking people in New York, and I get probably two or three calls a month from New York, from the city of New York. And
I'll be happy to help. Well, okay. Thank you very much for, first of all, this wonderful effort to get the word out about prostate cancer. You've shared your own personal experience, and I think you've illuminated a lot of men who otherwise might not be aware that there are other options when it comes to prostate cancer. We tend to have an assembly line type of medicine in this country where people just kind of click their heels and follow orders. But sometimes it requires an integrative approach to dealing with this condition. So I want to wish you all the best and much success.
Can I make one more quick comment on
this?
Sure,
please.
I have one client that's in the documentary under the patient section that had had surgery and almost died on the operating table, and they had to revive him. He then got a staph infection on the operating table, and they had to cure that. Then they said, well, we're not sure we got it all, so we're going to have to radiate you. So he did 8 weeks of radiation. Wow. They still weren't sure, so they gave him Lupron. And at that point, his wife stepped in and says, this is ridiculous. This is, and she was a very powerful woman in business. And up until this point, she'd left everything to the doctors and believed everything the doctors were telling them. And finally, she stepped in and said, we're stopping this nonsense. And she took him off Lupron. Unfortunately, they'd burnt his bladder. They'd burnt his rectum with the radiation. His sex life was gone, of course, with the surgery. I mean, he's living a life now, but if she had stepped in a lot earlier, he maybe would be a lot healthier today than in terms of his sex life than he is. It's important to get women involved. It's important to bring them in early on. It's important that they understand how it will affect their marriage.
Right. They can be important advocates for men because, men, I have to say, my observation is that women question more. Men tend to be more, it's almost like, you're in the army now. They just sort of follow orders, salute, and sometimes don't ask the proper questions before they embark on a course of therapy that may have long-term serious consequences. So this is an important conversation.
Yeah, women actually understand the relationship of stress and emotional trauma to disease than men do. Men that I've found, really, they shy away from dealing with the emotional traumas that they've lived through during their lives. Women get it immediately. And I get a very much better response from men dealing with the emotional side of the disease if the wife is involved, because she gets it. If the man's on his own, it's a lot more difficult thing.
And ultimately, prostate cancer can be a real wake-up call that can improve the quality of your life long-term and extend your life, because bottom line, the vast majority of men with prostate cancer don't die of their prostate cancer. They succumb to diabetes. They succumb to stroke and cardiovascular disease. And by making the changes that you've suggested, you can avert those problems.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's been really good to talk with you, and I've enjoyed very much this show. And I'm really happy you're doing what you're doing to get the word out also, so thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure. Peter Starr, who is producer of Surviving Prostate Cancer Without Surgery, Drugs, or Radiation. Get it at survivingprostatecancer.org. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.